Welcome to eHealth Learning, inspiring professionals worldwide.
So let's start. So really, really warm welcome to Sally Goddard-Blythe, who's talking to us from Chester. Sally runs the INPP, which is the Institute for Neurophysiological Psychology, which works with training lots of people all around the world now around neonatal reflexes, sometimes called primitive reflexes, and ways of working with them. And she's been really instrumental in that work for many years. I think her first book came out in 1996, and it was kind of the Bible of this work, really. And a lot of us therapists have referred to that for many years. So, and since then, she's written quite a few other books. And the new one that's just coming out, which she's going to talk about today, is this one, a really beautiful book called Movement, Your Child's First Language. And this is designed mostly for parents, but also for us therapists as well, to really understand the effects of some of these neonatal reflexes and how to work with them with music. She's got together with a Russian doctor, she'll talk about that a bit later, to produce some music and some really beautiful movement exercises and poems to go along with it. So it's a really wonderful book. So over to you, Sally. Do you want to say anything else about yourself before we start?
No, I think you've probably covered everything. Thank you.
Cool. Fantastic. I was talking about your other books that you've done, which I think is about seven in all now. And I was just, what inspired you to write this new one?
I think it was a need to try and bring together or pull together all the things that we've done in clinical practice and in publications and produce something practical that parents and nursery teachers and early years providers could actually do with children. We seem to have written so much about theory, but what parents really need, I think, is actually something that they can work with at home. And to remind them that there is a reason for many of the old-fashioned traditions that we associate with childcare. So I think those were the two main reasons that prompted this one.
Yeah. And since that your first book came out in 1996, I think it was, has your work changed much during that period of time?
Yes, in two main ways, probably. First of all, the language that we use to describe what we do. When Peter Blythe and David McGlown, who developed all this work way back in the sort of late 1970s and 80s, first devised programs and assessment protocols that we use, they used to talk in terms of reflexes, immature reflexes being the causes of the various difficulties that we were seeing. And we have changed that language very much to talk much more about those reflexes being signposts of immaturity in the functioning of the central nervous system. They're not the primary cause, but they are signposts which will be associated with specific difficulties with particular reflexes, which provide reflections of maturity in the central nervous system. So as clinicians, we can use them as tools, firstly, to assess whether neuromotor immaturity is present. Secondly, as indications to the level of development where we actually want to start our remedial intervention, because the whole idea behind the INPP theory is that you start from the bottom and you work upwards. So we start from the earliest point in development, which the assessment has suggested there is a problem, or the earliest reflex. And that will be the guideline as to our starting point for movement program, which is very different from many other movement programs. And then we can also use those reflexes during and after intervention to evaluate progress as a result of what we've done. And those tests can be used not just on the INPP program, but can be used as a tool for evaluation for osteopaths, cranial sacral therapists, lots of different disciplines who are putting in an intervention and want to see whether that intervention has made a change to the functioning of the system. So that's probably the main difference. And the other one, I suppose, that we have taken it beyond just an individual clinical program and adapted it to a school setting. So whereas in our clinical setting, we see families on a one-to-one basis, we assess the child and we put together an individualized program, the school program trains teachers in a one-day course how to do a much shorter screening test to identify those children who have signs of immaturity in the functioning of the nervous system. And then we put together a developmental movement program that follows development sequentially over the course of 1 year. And they use those exercises with a whole group or class of children over the course of a year under teacher supervision. So it's broadened the scope, really, of how the intervention can be used and made it less exclusive, I hope. That's the idea anyway.
Yes, fantastic. Thank you. And I think you're going to talk a little bit later about some support material for therapists as well.
Yes.
I'm going to go slightly off track here, just about, this is something of a fad of mine, because I work so much with babies and stuff, and the fact nowadays that babies spend so little time on their tummies, yes? Mm-hmm. And certainly we see this as therapists, lots of impacts of that as they grow up. But I'm just wondering from your work, what can you see, what are the impacts of babies spending much more time on their backs, do you think?
I'm not sure that we see a direct one-to-one connection in children's development, because we don't see them until they're older, until they're about 7. So it's very difficult to say, because they didn't have tummy time, this is why they have the problems later on. But in terms of looking at what children need not to have those problems later on, tummy time is important. It's not the only thing, of course, that we're sort of looking at the whole environment and opportunities and range of sensory and motor experiences that a child has in the first year of life. So that range of physical opportunities is important to develop head control and upper trunk control, because we always say that possibly the single most important thing a child ever learns to do in the first 6 weeks of life is to start to hold its head in the correct position in relation to its body. Because we know that when that head relationship with the body is correct, then postural control develops normally, balance develops normally, and muscle tone has the flexibility and the adaptation to cope with all the changes that are going to be demanded of it. So tummy time is a good way of starting to learn head control and upper trunk control, but it's also to have the opportunities for that freedom of movement in lots of different positions, not to be placed in a chair and left there where there is no need to learn how to move. And in learning how to move, how to get into different positions, how to reach for things and so on, that's also the beginning of cognitive problem solving. So it's not just about physical skills, it also has a sort of cognitive correlate. Together with things like developing the sense of body map, a child beginning to know where its body begins and ends in space, and giving it the baseline for postural stability, which has been found also to be linked to emotional stability. That when our posture and balance are insecure, we start to feel more anxious. And there are the other area of our work is working with adults who are suffering from anxiety, agoraphobia, and panic disorder, for which there is no obvious exogenous cause. And we find that the common denominator in that group is that they have underlying problems with vestibular functioning and postural control. And when that starts to be improved, some of the anxiety and emotional symptoms also start to remiss.
Thank you. Fascinating. Thank you. So in your book, there's two CDs of music there. Composed by Dr. Lazarev, I think. And, music is so universal, isn't it? And particularly with babies and children, when you put on music, they almost instinctively want to move to it. Why do you think there's such a correlation between music and movement?
Well, it's going to be quite a long answer if you're okay, but if you want to interrupt me, that's fine. So to start off with the first bit, that children detect the music of language long before they understand streams of words. And there was some wonderful research done at the University of Edinburgh by Professor Colwyn Trevathan and his colleagues, where they took video footage of mother-infant conversations. And they showed how if the mother used very short phrases, and then paused for a few seconds and allowed the infant time to process that information, the infant would give a perfect answering musical phrase in return. But the important part was allowing the infant the time to process what had just been done. So the idea that language is essentially musical seems to be there from the very beginning. And if we think about it, things like the cooing and babbling of the infant are musical in nature. Melody and timing are parts of communication that convey the intention of the communicator. And rhythm, we know from all sorts of different types of music, sets the mood and influences levels of arousal. So music is present in language long before we start to understand words. And if we go back to the sort of link between movement and sound, both movement and sound together are a child's primary means of expression. So children make their needs felt through a combination of gesture and mime and mimicry. And they're very, very good at this. From several days after birth, they will actually mimic human expressions when somebody is looking at them. And these are the nonverbal aspects of language, which interestingly support up to 90% of effective communication later on. But perhaps words are not as important as we think they are. And studies that have looked at mother ease, which is sometimes described as infant-directed speech, have shown that this type of speech, which has that sing-song quality, is particularly appealing and interesting to babies. Babies pay more attention to that type of conversation than an adult coming in and using normal speech. And one of the things that mother ease also does is it slows down the sounds of speech, making it easier for the baby to start to detect and differentiate between different speech sounds long before they learn to talk for themselves. And then there's the element of sound itself, or sound and motion, that music grew from movement and is in itself the expression of movement. It developed from the rhythms and calls of the natural world and the human world, things like the beating of drums, the stamping of feet, the calls and cries of the natural world. And what we understand as sound is actually a specific range of frequencies that are detected by the human ear and then perceived by the human brain. So even what we think of as sound is actually a specific range of motion frequencies. So movement and sound are not so much entirely different things. And these are the things that babies understand from the beginning. And this sort of link between movement and sound is in all sorts of different types of music. So if we go to classical music, and you said that you were a classical musician, so I'm probably bringing Coles to Newcastle. But if we think of things like Bach orchestral suites, these are all based on dance rhythms, things like minuets, saraband, pavane, and so on. Very sort of elegant and dignified and very structured. But then when we listen to something like Latin American music or rock and roll, that has a completely different beat and rhythm that immediately makes us start to want to move in different ways. So sound and music has the capacity to make us want to move, and movement is a part of music as well. So I don't know whether I've probably gone off piste a lot on this, but whether that answered your question, I don't know.
Yeah, no, fantastic. Thank you. So in your book, you've got a whole series of suggested movement exercises, haven't you, to do with each track of the CDs. And I was just wondering if you could explain a little bit about the purpose of those specific movements.
So the characters, the animal characters in the stories, loosely mirror different stages of infant movement development. And depending on your school of thought, perhaps also mirror stages of our own evolution. So we start in the womb, the nature of the movements we make are fish-like, Piscean. Then when we first few weeks and months after birth, the type of movements we make are more reptilian, and then we go onto hands and knees, and it's more like a mammalian stage. Then we cruise on our feet, still using our hands to support balance and motion, which is like a brief simian phase. And then hopefully we become in control of upright posture with free use of the hands for all the things that make us uniquely human. So what we've done with these songs is to go back and replicate those stages, but with stories and poems and songs to try and make it fun. And those stories and songs should suggest to the children the type of movements that they make to act out the characters in the story. So it should be a play-based creative activity. It's not like a structured therapeutic program.
Great, thank you. Again, sort of more with my musician hat now. I'm interested in this thing about live music, particularly, and you know, traditionally music has always been played live. And I know in some educational places like Steiner schools, they insist on music being played live still. But and of course, with live music, you get a lot of variation in things like rhythm. You know, it's constantly changing subtly, and also pitch and things like that. Whereas now, most people listen to music which has, you know, pretty simple chord structures, I would say less sophisticated in a way, and also a very, very regular beat. A lot of music now is computer-based, really. So you have loops, which are constant beat. I'm just wondering if that, if you've got any thoughts about this effect on children or development.
Well, I entirely agree with what you're saying. Is that there is a big difference between live performance and recorded music, because music is expression of the movement of the performer or the performers, which, just like writing your signature, are never exactly the same every time. And so those small changes and differences keep live performance literally alive. It sounds like obvious, whereas the recorded one, as you said, you've got this perfect replication, but it's exactly the same every time. You don't get the variation, you don't get the dynamics, because dynamics means a change of force of some kind or another. And it's that constant change that keeps something interesting and arousing and just different. And I think that although it's lovely to be able to listen to whatever music you want to listen to whenever you can, it has made us perhaps self-critical of our own performance. I know that one of the questions that perhaps comes a little bit later is about parents singing to their children and nursery rhymes and so on. And I think one of the downsides of musical, of recorded music, is that those of us who are not professional musicians always feel slightly embarrassed and inhibited about our performance, because we normally listen to something that is nearly perfect. Whereas 50, 100 years ago, that wasn't so common. And people, I think, used to participate much more in just enjoying music together, performing music together. The other thing about live music is what you can learn from the people alongside you. So my three children were all choristers at the cathedral when they were younger. And I can remember being very struck about how the probationers, when they went in at 7 or 8 years of age, they could barely read music, if at all. They started off by miming in the hope that the master choristers wouldn't notice that they weren't singing the right notes. And they were sandwiched between senior choristers on either side. And so their primary learning in that environment was by ear and by imitation. And the more they sang, the better their imitation became, the better their performance became, the better the ear became at detecting whether they got it right or wrong. As they practice daily and they start to learn to match the sounds they sing to the musical symbols on the page, so reading age starts to improve. And the more they sing, the greater the variety of the music, the richer their vocabulary of musical possibilities becomes. So their ability to pitch gets better, pitch certain intervals, to reproduce complex rhythms and introduce emotion into their singing. And that's something which you don't get from listening to the same thing over and over again. And I can remember when the boys would start to intone some of the responses for Evensong, they would often imitate the lay clerks, the gentlemen of the choir that they'd heard from behind, and you would get this wonderful reproduction of the intonation of those texts, which I don't think they would ever learn by just listening to the same recording over and over again. It gives something different.
Hmm. Interesting. And you mentioned about nursery rhymes and things like that, and parents singing. I hadn't thought about that, people feeling self-conscious about it, but I guess that's...
I do, all the time. Self-conscious, I mean.
Yeah. But, because that always has been a tradition for so many years, hasn't it? Fathers, mothers singing to their nursery rhymes and things like this, which is seems to be dying out. Maybe it isn't, but it seems.
I think there are some who still do, but I think there's time pressures on parents, both parents now. An emerging generation, maybe, who've had little experience of being sung to themselves. And, you know, so much of what we do as parents, we have absorbed from our own childhood experiences. And if that hasn't been a part of it, then perhaps it's beginning to die out with each generation that comes along. The development of recorded music that we've talked about, and electronic media, which makes it so much easier to press a button and keep your child entertained while you get on with something else, which may be fine occasionally, but it's completely different from the child having that social engagement and interactive experience with the parent, which studies have shown, which you're probably familiar with, that when we do anything together, when we are in any form of social interaction, it's said to increase the levels of oxytocin, the hormone that is involved, obviously, in childbirth and in breastfeeding, but has also been found to be involved in the setting of emotional bonds in social relationships. So as soon as you replace yourself with an electronic device, you are potentially interfering with the ability to make those chemical bonding connections, which are so important for the basis of human relationships all through life.
Thank you. And but before we started, you talked a little bit about Dr. Lazarus' work with pregnant mums and music. And I'm just wondering, when you met him, was that a big game change for you in the direction of your work, would you say?
I think we have known about children's ability, the fetus's ability to hear from the third trimester of pregnancy and possibly a little bit earlier for a long time, and all the things could be done with sound therapy and music. But I had never come across someone who seemed to have the knowledge and ability to tap into the developmental levels of the child with the music that he wrote and make it absolutely right. So it's probably worth telling a little story about this. When he was starting to write the music for the CD that's now in the book, he said he already had what he described as his zoo program in Russia. And as part of that, he had a song called The Crocodile. It's got very sort of funky rhythm to it. And I was working in Poland a number of years ago. And at the end of the conference, a number of families had booked in to see me to have a look at their children. And some of the children were quite severely impaired. And I was looking at a little 6.5-year-old boy with autism. We were working through a translator, and part of the way through the session, the translator just left to go and take her lunch. So we had no ability to communicate with each other at all. I thought, rather than sitting here in silence looking at each other for half an hour, perhaps I'll just put the CD on in the background. So this little boy had limited language in Polish. He certainly didn't understand what we had been talking about in English. And he spontaneously got down on the floor and started to crawl across the floor like a crocodile in time to the music. So something about Lazarus' rhythms actually are absolutely right for the movements that you want the children to make. Plus the fact that he's written some wonderful poems and songs where the language itself is rich in vocabulary for children at different ages. So I think he provided for me the missing link. I knew I wanted music, but I didn't know how I could find the music that I wanted to go with what we were doing. And here was someone who seemed to understand both.
Wonderful. Thank you. I think you've touched a little bit on this before, but just this thing about technology and you know, babies, well, even babies actually, and certainly children using things like iPads so early. I'm just wondering if you've got any thoughts about the effects of this on development. I know you've touched on them.
I think there are two ways of looking at it. There is the research that has indicated that it can have an adverse effect if it's overused at a too younger age. And some of those problems include things like possible effects on eyesight later on, a tendency for children to become much more nearsighted at an early age, that it potentially affects the brain waves associated with different stages of attention and the ability to shift attention rapidly from one task to another. and also that it may increase the levels of dopamine, one of the neurotransmitters in the system, which is associated with the reward systems in the brain and potentially with addictive type problems. Now, no one is saying that e-media does cause that, but potentially overuse of it might place a child at higher risk. But actually what I'm more interested in is what electronic media does not do, what the child is not doing during the time that it's engaged in these games and activities and things. So what it's not doing is being engaged in physical activity, which develops postural mechanisms, motor control, body awareness, and so on. It's not experienced in the same way, the sensory stimulation that occurs when we are directly physically involved in something. So I have two wonderful photos that I show when I'm doing a PowerPoint presentation. One of three of my grandchildren playing in a field of lavender. And simply by looking at that photo, you can actually sense, you can smell what happens when they run through it and they touch it and they release the sense into the atmosphere. The child who's never done that and looks at a field of lavender thinks, well, that's interesting, but they have no understanding of the olfactory, tactile, all the other sensory experiences that go along with it. So yes, you can learn a lot from it, but it's not the same in terms of the whole body understanding of the world that it's introducing you to. It doesn't develop that inner sense of body position in space and body awareness. So way, way back in the late 60s and 70s, a man called Ray Barsh wrote some wonderful books on motor perceptual efficiency. And he described the young child as a terranaut, not a terrorist, but an astronaut on terra firma. And he said the child's first task in life was to develop mastery or control of his or her own body in space. When they had that control developed, they were then free to go and explore the world in all sorts of different ways and know that they had self-control as well. And so lots of time spent sitting passively doing this is not the same process. And finally, the games and activities that are set in these programs are just that. They are pre-programmed by a particular type of mindset and by the constraints of the digital medium. So they're not flexible or adaptive to what the child is doing. They are going to respond in a set number of ways and program the child also to respond in a set number of ways. You don't get the adaptability and flexibility that you get in normal human interaction and conversation. So it's a different process, and it's rather like going back to Colwyn Trevathan's work with the young babies, that if the mother waited, the baby would give the perfect answering phrase. He then shows some additional footage where somebody comes in from outside who doesn't understand this game and this conversation, and they look at the baby and they go, bah, 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 and they don't wait for the baby, and they carry on. And the baby almost folds its arms and looks as if to say, well, don't you understand the manners of good conversation? And it gives up trying. So this sensitive, sympathetic listening is an incredibly important part of a child's desire to communicate and to continue to communicate. And there's something about the medium of electronic media that doesn't do it in exactly the same way.
I love that analogy of the going through a field. It's beautiful. So you mentioned about your children being in a choir. My youngest was also in a local choir, and it was such an amazing thing. And from my experience as a music teacher as well, you see the effects of learning an instrument through things like learning to breathe, your posture, coordination, listening, all those things coming together. And I know that funding for music lessons and music in general has been cut a lot recently, hasn't it, over the last few years. And then I'm just wondering, you know, socially how that affects us in a way, and culturally. Obviously you speak a lot about these kind of subjects. What can we do to get the message out a bit more?
I think by making a big noise about it, really, by lobbying politicians, academics, educationists, and parents about how musical training is not just about music. It enhances all sorts of other skills. And there's a wealth of research indicating that there's a crossover from musical activity to improved performance in other areas of learning. And there's one study carried out in 2014 at the University of Graz in Austria called Every Child an Instrument, where they went into schools and they were giving every child in classes an instrument and so much instrumental training. And then they were using magnetic resonance imaging and another form of imaging, I can't remember exactly what it was, to see what the effects on the brain were of the musical training in children who had no diagnosis of any particular type of learning or attention problem, compared to children who had ADHD, ADD, and possibly dyspraxia, I think. But what the imaging showed was that there was enhanced left-right hemispheric synchronization in those children who were having the regular musical training. And sorry, I need to put my glasses on to read this. And the anatomical characteristics were positively correlated with frequency discrimination, reading, and spelling skills. And other studies I know have shown links to improved spatial ability, to maths, and you've already talked about the things like listening, the auditory discrimination, which is a precursor to being able to read, to spell, and to write. And I grew up in a musical family. My father was a professional classical musician. So from before, ever since I can remember, music was always there. And I can't imagine a life without it. But I know that when one of my sons was a lay clerk and he was singing at one of the cathedrals in the Northwest, and they went out as a choir to one of the poorer areas of the city. And they'd been singing Evensong, I think, near Christmas that year. And they processed out, and because the area was pretty rough, they thought they were all going to get sort of taunted in their cassocks and everything as they came out. And I will change the language slightly, but one of them heard one of the young men just listening outside saying, "I've never heard anything so effing beautiful in my life." And to think that he had reached the age, probably early 20s, and never come across what we would think of as classical music, I thought was an absolute travesty. The fact that he was able to appreciate it is wonderful. But we know that classical music or musical training, instrumental training, singing, any kind of musical training, actually enhances and supports other skills. And to see it being squeezed out of the curriculum because of finances or because of a desire to improve outcomes at the end of education is, in my view, very short-sighted.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. In your book, you mentioned briefly about Brain Gym as a fairly popular way of working with neonatal reflexes. And could you just explain how your approach and INPP approach differs from that?
Very different. As I mentioned earlier, INPP works from the bottom up. We start from the brain stem and work up towards the cortex in terms of the type of movements and the sensory systems that we are stimulating. And the developmental stages of activities used between the two programs are very different. So INPP works in a developmental sequence using the reflexes, primitive and postural reflexes, as indicators as to where we need to start and how we need to progress through a movement program, which is very much made for the individual client based on an assessment of those reflexes. And so the assessment tools we use are medically recognized tests for primitive and postural reflexes, balance and motor coordination. And those are reassessed at 6 to 8 weekly intervals. And depending on the progress that has been made, the developmental nature of the exercises will be moved forward or moved higher on. And as the postural control and balance improve, so you see the eye movements needed to support reading, writing, copying, catching a ball, and so on starting to improve. And therefore, visual perceptual skills, which provide the basis for reading and writing. So by working with posture and balance, moving up to centers involved in the control of eye movements, this is where the link to educational difficulties comes in sort of neurological and cognitive terms. Whereas Brain Gym, my understanding of it, trains generally other higher or developmentally later skills, which is fine if that's the level of competence that the child has when they start. If it isn't, they will improve on those brain gym exercises, but those skills will not, in my view, become a fully integrated function. They will be skills that need to continue to be practiced all the time to keep the performance up. If you have started the intervention program much higher than the developmental capabilities of the child that you're working with. So it's a different approach. One is saying, well, you know, if we teach crossing the midline, if we teach cross pattern creeping or crawling, which is part of a brain gym program, then by doing that, we'll get improved interhemispheric communication. And you probably do. But unless you've done the underneath work, it's rather like putting the icing on the cake before the cake is fully baked.
Yeah, I see. And what about other kind of approaches that are popular as well, like brushing, for example?
It depends what variety of brushing you're using. Brushing has been around for many, many years, has been used by occupational therapists trained in sensory integration techniques, but it's used within quite strict guidelines in a therapeutic setting, because it has been found that you can overstimulate with brushing, and therefore if it is misused, you can cause as many problems as you solve. So I suppose, rather than talking about specific programs, I would say if you have concerns, I would ask, is there any evidence to support the claims that are made for the efficacy of the method that is being used? What are the presenting symptoms of the child? Does the child seem to have a lot of tactile hypersensitivity or hyposensitivity issues? And to find out or research the history of brushing and see which system of brushing is most appropriate for the problems that are being presented to you.
Thank you. I know that in many countries that around the world, your work is much more widely accepted actually than it is in the UK, which is strange really. I'm just wondering why it's been so slow to be embraced in the education system here.
I think there are several reasons, some of which there is, I understand the reasoning behind it. I think the first in the UK is that we have crossed possibly too many professional disciplines. So the method of assessment we use is taken directly from mainstream medicine. The intervention techniques we use are perhaps closer to conventional physiotherapy or occupational therapy. The application of it is to problems of an educational nature. And those of us that started the system come from a background in psychology. So we have dipped our feet in several different other professional domains without actually belonging neatly in any one of them, which has made it difficult for the health service cannot accept it because it doesn't come from medicine. And teachers have very little training these days in how physical development supports learning. I've been absolutely horrified when I've gone and done lectures and training days for probationary teachers, for teachers who've been in teaching for a number of years, and asked, how much time did you spend on physical development other than those that are involved in early years? Sometimes they've had one lecture. Many of them are not now familiar with the names like Piaget. And so we have a generation of teachers who are in schools and through no fault of their own, do not understand how physical development links to learning success. And therefore, there is a gap in the system between how do you then take the child, there are teachers recognizing there's an educational problem, where do you find the place to have them assessed physically, and how do you put an intervention program together? And that's what we've tried to do with our schools program that we developed. It's published and it's available, but it still doesn't quite fit into anybody's box, which then brings us on to the next sort of criticism, which is, what is the evidence to show that what we have developed actually works? And the evidence is there, but it depends which bit of it you're looking at. So, in 2004, the Department of Education in Northern Ireland commissioned a study, an independent study, in six schools, mainstream schools in Northern Ireland, to look into the screening tests that we developed for schools to see what the incidence of neuromotor immaturity was in mainstream schools in 5 to 8 year olds, to then introduce our intervention program for schools and to see whether the intervention program improved the physical measures of neuromotor immaturity. And then the third part, or third and fourth parts, was to see, was there a correlation between less mature physical school skills and lower educational performance, which there was. And then, if the neuromotor skills improved, did you then get a significant improvement in educational measures? So it was looking at an awful lot of different things. And what it showed then was that 48% of the 5 to 6 year olds showed some signs of immature reflexes, more than 25%, which is what we would consider to be the cutoff score of more than the normal range. 35% of 8 to 9 year olds showed a similar profile, which in those days I thought was an extremely high percentage. If it was representative of the general school population, it suggested nearly half of children at the time of school entry did not have all the physical skills in place they ideally need to cope with the demands of the classroom. And nearly a third are showing a similar profile 2 to 3 years later. It showed there was a correlation between less mature physical skills and lower educational achievement. And it also showed that those children who took part in the exercise program made significantly greater improvements in the neuromotor measures than those that did not, which is important because medically it is still sometimes stated you cannot change those reflexes, that they are a sign of pathology and there's nothing you can do about it. So the fact that those groups did show significant changes shows that the program does improve neuromotor functioning. Now, the problem in that study was that the number of children who then fitted the criteria for the program, which was more than 25% neuromotor immaturity and underperformance education at the outset, were not large enough to reach statistical significance with control and comparison groups. And so the criticism we still hear when we're trying to get new research done in schools is, oh, but the 2005 study did not conclusively show that this improves educational performance. That's actually not quite true. What it said was there were not great enough numbers to show that. The general trend suggested that yes, it did, but further research is needed to show conclusively that there is a relationship between the two. So that's where we are at the moment, is trying to actually get more research done. On top of that, much more recently, some colleagues linked to the University of Loughborough have done a smaller study where they used the Movement ABC2 test battery, which is a recognized motor assessment battery, alongside the screening IMPP screening test for younger children. And the Movement ABC has suggested in the last 13 years, I think, or is it 11 years? Certainly between 11 and 13 years anyway, there's been something like a 13 to 18% decline in children's physical skills on that motor test battery. And our screening test is showing exactly the same thing. So there is a growing body of research to show that more needs to be done, but the criticism is, well, because the last part didn't show everything we wanted it to, there's an unwillingness to provide the funding to do more. But I'm not giving up on that, we're still going. And then in other countries, such as Germany, for example, the whole health system is different. They have what they call ergotherapy, which is like a generalized therapy where a doctor can write a prescription for a family for therapies similar to occupational therapy, sensory integration, speech and language therapy, of which the IMPP method has been accepted. And those families can take that like a prescription to an IMPP practitioner and get that treatment with the approval of the health service, which is something we don't have in the United Kingdom. We haven't made that leap. And Hungary, for example, I know my colleague there says there is the whole culture there is one of motor training programs. Everybody has within their thinking that motor training programs have been around for a long time. They are an important part of the culture. And therefore it's been much easier to introduce a different type of motor training program into Hungary and for it to be accepted.
Thank you. That 2005 study, was it published?
It was published, first of all, it was published as an independent report, which we can send out from our website if anyone is interested. So I had nothing to do with the writing of that. And then a year later, I wrote up the findings of that study together with lots of small pilot projects on the same thing. And that was published in a peer-reviewed journal called Childcare in Practice in 2005 under the title Releasing Educational Potentials Through Movement. So that was published, yes.
Fantastic. So do you have a sort of simple test at home kind of protocol that therapists could use in their practice? which you have it.
This was published in 2014. It's called Neuromotor Immaturity in Children and Adults, the IMPP screening test for clinicians and health practitioners. Because we realize that many other health practitioners are interested, that are two areas of work linked, but they don't have time to do the full assessments and see children through a program like we would. So it's important for them to be able to recognize when this is an issue, just as we hopefully recognize when children come to us and there seem to be skeletal issues which need manual therapy to try and free that up before we try and do the functional work with movement.
Just to get the title of that, that was called Neuromotor Immaturity
in Children and Adults, the IMPP screening test for clinicians and health practitioners. So that was published by Wiley Blackwell in 2014 and is generally available.
Great. Thank you. And also, do you have a list of practitioners on your site that you've trained? I know you train people all over the world.
We do. If you go onto our website and you click on contacts, it will bring up a list of those who are training and practicing according to the sort of ethical guidelines that we give. In order to obtain their addresses, you need just to contact us and we can pass on the email address, but it will tell you where they are in the country. And it will also give you a list to all the international heads who provide training in the IMPP method in countries other than the UK, because training is available now, I think, in 14 or 15 countries.
Lovely. And so I think your website is inpp.org.uk, isn't it?
Yes.
Cool. So we're getting towards the end now. I put this question out. If there was one piece of advice you could give to a new mother, what would it be?
Enjoy your children when you can and don't try to be perfect. Our children grow up in spite of us.
Yeah, there is that the phrase, isn't it, from attachment theory, the good enough mother, or is it the good enough parent anyway?
Yes.
I really like. Very good. So the book is out soon. Well, I think it's actually hit the shelves already, hasn't it?
It has, yes.
So it's this one. And you can get it from the publishers, which is Hawthorne Press, which is just hawthornepress.com, or other online booksellers. And I'm just wondering if there's any other questions from people who are listening. So please, if you've got any last questions for Sally before we end, please do put them in the chat box if you're on Zoom, or if you want to put them in the comment section on Facebook Live. I'll just put them to Sally. Is there anything else you'd like to say, Sally?
No, I think your list of questions has covered everything I can think of.
Good. Oh, just see if there's any last questions.
There's two things coming up on chat. I don't know whether that's new or whether that's been there all the time.
No, that was there before. It was just about, right. There's something in the Q&A. I'll just have a quick look at that. Benta. Benta is from Norway. She's saying, very interesting. Thank you. Okay, good. All right. Well, thank you very much, Sally. And that was really, really fascinating. We'd love to have you back at some point if you'd be willing to.
Yes.
To maybe talk about something perhaps more specifically around this subject, because it's so important, really so important. And so our next webinar that we have here is on Thursday, the 27th of September. That's in the morning, actually, at 10 a.m. UK time. That's on the the temporomandibular joint. So TMD, temporomandibular joint disorders and things like that, and how to work with them. So thank you, everybody. And thank you again, Sally. There's a comment from Janet on Facebook saying, "This book and training changed how I viewed my clinical practice. It led me to take the full INPP course, never look back." So thank you,
Janet. And thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Sally. And good luck with the book. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.